It is 1971. A tired paper company in Wisconsin has just handed the keys to its in-house lawyer. Within weeks, doctors will tell him he is dying. What he does next is the reason a business book sold millions of copies, and the reason a lot of chief executives still talk in its vocabulary 30 years later. Today, Good to Great by Jim Collins. What it says, where it is wrong, and what it means when the leader, or the team, is neurodivergent. From the Reading Room, this is 60 Books. I'm Miles. Every episode, one management book that a chief executive might quote at you, taken apart in 20 minutes. The idea is simple. When someone across the table says the words, "Get the right people on the bus," you should know exactly where that came from, what it actually claims, and how it plays when the people on the bus think differently. Nora, you have been living inside this book for a week.
I have. And I want to start where Collins starts, which is with a man nobody expected anything from.
Set the scene for me.
So, 1971. Kimberly-Clark is a paper company, coated paper mostly, and it is not a good one. Its stock has trailed the general market for 20 years. It is the kind of company that is fine. It is not going anywhere.
Right.
And the board has to pick a new chief executive. They pick Darwin Smith. Smith is the company's in-house lawyer. He is mild-mannered. He grew up on a farm in Indiana and worked his way through school. If you were casting a movie about a great CEO, you would not cast Darwin Smith.
What did the board think of him?
Collins tells this story, where one of the directors takes Smith aside, right after the appointment, and tells him he is not sure Smith has all the qualifications for the job.
To his face.
To his face. And then, 2 months in, Smith gets diagnosed with nose and throat cancer. His doctors give him less than a year.
HM.
And here is the first thing that tells you who this man is. He goes to the board and tells them he has no plans to die anytime soon. And he keeps working. He commutes every week from Wisconsin to Houston for radiation. And he lives another 25 years.
So he is running a mediocre paper company while getting radiation treatment.
While getting radiation. And somewhere in there, he reaches the decision that the whole book hangs on. He looks at the core business, coated paper, and he concludes the company will never be great at it. Where it could be great is in consumer paper products. Kleenex, Huggies, brands people buy every week.
Which means going up against
Procter & Gamble, head to head. And to do it, he sells the mills. He sells the paper mills, including the one in Kimberly, Wisconsin, the town the company is named for.
What did Wall Street say?
Wall Street called it stupid. The business press called it dumb. Collins is very specific that this was the consensus view. The quiet lawyer with cancer had just bet the company on a fight with the biggest consumer goods company on earth.
And 20 years later.
20 years later, Kimberly-Clark is the leading consumer paper company in the world. It has beaten Procter & Gamble in 6 of 8 product categories. It owns Scott Paper, its old rival, outright. And by Collins's count, its stock returned about 4 times the general market over that stretch.
And Smith.
Smith, when someone asked him later how he did it, said he never stopped trying to become qualified for the job.
That is a very different kind of answer.
It is the whole point of the book. Collins went looking for larger-than-life leaders and found Darwin Smith.
Before we get into the ideas, tell me about the man who wrote this.
Jim Collins, born 1958, Colorado for most of his life. He studied mathematical sciences at Stanford, then did an MBA there. Short stints at McKinsey and at Hewlett-Packard, then back to Stanford's business school to teach, where he won a distinguished teaching award. And in 1995, he leaves the university and sets up what he calls a management laboratory in Boulder. That is where the research teams work to this day.
And this was not his first book.
No, his first big one was Built to Last, with Jerry Porras, in 1994. That book studied companies that had been excellent for generations, and there is a dinner story here that I love. A McKinsey partner named Bill Meehan takes Collins out and tells him, more or less, your book is useless.
Useless.
Because every company in it was great from the beginning, so it tells you nothing if you are running a merely good company and want to become great, and Collins takes the insult seriously. That challenge becomes Good to Great.
How did he go about it?
5 years, a rotating team of roughly 20 researchers. They screened 1,435 companies that had appeared on the Fortune 500, looking for a very specific shape. 15 years of stock returns at or below the market, a transition point, and then 15 years of returns at least 3 times the market.
And how many made it?
11. Abbott, Circuit City, Fannie Mae, Gillette, Kimberly-Clark, Kroger, Nucor, Philip Morris, Pitney Bowes, Walgreens, and Wells Fargo. Each one paired with a comparison company in the same industry that had the same shot and did not make the leap.
I want you to remember that list, because we are coming back to it.
We are. The book comes out in 2001 and becomes one of the best-selling business books ever. He follows it with How the Mighty Fall in 2009, Great by Choice with Morten Hansen in 2011, and a short monograph called Turning the Flywheel in 2019. And the human detail, he is a serious rock climber, has been for decades, and he talks about climbing exactly the way he talks about companies. Preparation, discipline, a long series of small moves.
Okay, the ideas. Collins builds the book as 7 concepts.
7, and they stack in order. The first is level 5 leadership, and that is the Darwin-Smith idea. Collins expected charisma at the top of his 11 companies. He found the opposite. Modest, sometimes shy people, who were at the same time ferociously determined. He calls it a paradoxical blend of personal humility and professional will.
What does that look like day to day?
They channel ambition into the company, not into themselves. They give credit out the window and take blame in the mirror. And they set their successors up to succeed rather than to look small by comparison. The comparison companies, meanwhile, tended to hire celebrated outsiders. The company did well while the star was there and fell apart when the star left.
Number 2.
First who, then what? This is the bus. The good to great leaders did not start with a vision and then recruit people to it. They got the right people on the bus, the wrong people off, the right people in the right seats, and only then decided where to drive.
Why that order?
2 reasons. With the right people, the problem of motivating and managing mostly disappears. And when the world changes, the right people can change direction with you. There are 2 rules that come out of it. When in doubt, do not hire, keep looking. And when you know you need to make a people change, act. He is careful about the words. Rigorous, not ruthless. They did not churn people. They also did not let a wrong fit sit for years.
3.
Confront the brutal facts. The great companies faced reality without flinching, and they built a climate where the truth could be heard. He gives 4 practices. Lead with questions, not answers. Engage in debate, not coercion. Conduct autopsies without blame. And build what he calls red flag mechanisms, ways of turning information into information you cannot ignore.
This is the chapter with the Admiral.
The Stockdale Paradox. Jim Stockdale was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 8 years and was tortured repeatedly. Collins asks him who did not make it out. And Stockdale says, the optimists.
The optimists.
The ones who said, we will be out by Christmas, then Easter, then Thanksgiving, and in his words, they died of a broken heart. Stockdale's own stance was to hold 2 things at once, absolute faith that he would prevail in the end, and the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of his current reality, whatever they were. Collins argues that dual stance is what let the great companies make hard decisions without losing hope.
4.
The hedgehog concept, borrowed from an Isaiah Berlin essay. The fox knows many things, the hedgehog knows 1 big thing. The great companies were hedgehogs, each found 1 simple organizing idea at the intersection of 3 circles, what they could be the best in the world at, what drove their economic engine, and what they were deeply passionate about.
Give me the example.
Walgreens, it decided it could be the best in the world at convenient drugstores. It measured itself on profit per customer visit instead of profit per store, and it cared about that. It sounds trivial until you notice how many companies chase things they are merely good at. And Collins is emphatic that a hedgehog concept is not a goal and not a strategy. It is an understanding, and it usually takes years of iterating to find.
5.
Culture of discipline. Disciplined people, disciplined thought, disciplined action. The great companies gave people freedom and responsibility inside a clear framework and then trusted them. Nucor, the steel company, is the example. People worked hard because the system rewarded it and carried no passengers, and there is this odd image that readers never forget. The triathlete Dave Scott, who was said to rinse his cottage cheese to get the last bit of fat off.
Rinse his cottage cheese.
It is Collins's picture of someone doing the small disciplined thing nobody else bothers with. The flip side of this chapter is the stop doing list. The great companies were as clear about what they would not do as about what they would.
6.
Technology accelerators. None of the 11 pioneered a technology. None of them made the leap because of 1. What they did was ask whether a technology fit their hedgehog concept. If it did, they became pioneers in applying it. If not, they ignored it. Walgreens built a serious web presence, but only after it worked out how the web served convenient drugstores, while a heavily funded online rival burned its cash and vanished. Technology accelerates momentum. It does not create it.
And 7.
The flywheel. Picture a huge, heavy metal disc on an axle. You push and it barely moves. You push again, same direction. Eventually it turns once, then twice, then faster until its own weight is doing the work. Collins says that is what every transition looked like from inside. No single defining moment. No launch. Outsiders saw a breakthrough. Insiders saw years of consistent pushes.
And the opposite.
He calls it the doom loop. The comparison companies lurched. New program, new acquisition, new savior, each push in a new direction, so no momentum ever built.
So here is where I have to push. Remember the list.
Circuit City.
Circuit City.
Bankrupt in 2008. Liquidated the next year. Fannie Mae went into government conservatorship in September of 2008 after an accounting scandal earlier that decade. And Wells Fargo, which the book holds up for its culture of discipline, became infamous in 2016 for opening millions of unauthorized customer accounts.
What does Collins say to that?
In How the Mighty Fall, he argues companies decline when they stop practicing the principles, not because the principles are wrong. And there is something to it. But notice what it does to the framework. If a company succeeds, it proves the model. If it fails, it abandons the model. That is hard to falsify.
And there is a deeper critique.
Phil Rosenzweig, 2007, a book called The Halo Effect. His argument is that Collins picked his companies on the outcome, great stock performance, and then went looking for what they had in common. That is a classic research error. And worse, the evidence, the interviews, and the press coverage is contaminated by the halo. When a company is doing well, everyone remembers its leaders as humble and its culture as disciplined. When it stumbles, the same people remember arrogance and drift.
So the data may be describing how success gets narrated,
rather than what causes it, which does not make the book useless. It makes it a very well-organized checklist of things that plausibly help, not a proven causal law, and that is the right tier for this whole shelf, practitioner literature. Widely read, highly quotable, not peer-reviewed evidence.
Okay, now the reason this show exists. Let me say the summary again, and then turn it. For a neurodivergent chief executive, or one leading neurodivergent people, good to great reads as a case for building a company around structure instead of charisma. Quiet leadership over performance. The right people in seats shaped to them. Brutal facts said out loud and heard without punishment. One narrow focus, and a flywheel that keeps turning on the days when nobody's attention or energy is at full strength.
And a flag before we start. This is coaching judgment applied to practitioner material. It is a way to talk, not a research finding. And profiles vary. What follows is about tendencies, not about any one person.
Understood, and I want to do this in three passes. ADHD first, then autism, then the leader who has both, because that is a different conversation.
It is.
So, a chief executive with ADHD reads good to great. Which chapters should sting?
The hedgehog and the flywheel, and they sting for the same reason. ADHD in a leader often shows up as a pull toward the new. New market, new product, new hire, new tool. Each one is exciting, and each one is a push in a new direction. Collins has a name for that.
The doom loop.
The doom loop. So the hedgehog concept becomes a guardrail rather than a philosophy. Three circles. Can we be the best in the world at it? Does it drive the engine? Do we care? A leader with ADHD can run that check in 30 seconds on every shiny opportunity, and it gives them a way to say no that does not depend on willpower.
And the flywheel.
The flywheel is the answer to variable attention. If the company runs on the leader's focus, it will have great weeks and lost weeks. So the coaching move is to build the wheel so it turns without the leader's daily push. Fixed cadences that happen whether or not anyone feels like it. Ownership delegated to people whose consistency is their strength. Scoreboards reviewed on a schedule, not on a mood. First who, in the ADHD frame, means hiring for the traits you do not have, and then letting those people hold the rhythm.
What about culture of discipline? That word discipline lands hard on people with ADHD.
It does, and Collins's version is kinder than it sounds. Freedom and responsibility inside a clear framework. For an ADHD leader, that is permission to build the framework once, outside their own head, and stop relying on self-control. And the stop doing list is the best tool in the book for this profile. 3 things we will not do this year, written down, visible.
And if a CEO with ADHD brings this book up,
ask what their hedgehog is, and then ask what they said no to last quarter because of it. If they cannot name a no, the book has not landed yet.
Second pass, autism, which chapters?
Level 5 and brutal facts. Start with level 5. Collins's great leaders were quiet, did not self-promote, and were ferociously determined. Many autistic leaders fit that description without trying. The will is there. The mission focus is there. What is often missing is the performance of confidence that boards and investors expect.
Which is the Darwin-Smith problem?
Exactly the Darwin-Smith problem. Read as unqualified because they do not present the way a leader is supposed to present. So the coaching move is to separate self-promotion from will and make the ambition for the institution visible in ways that do not require performing. Written strategy. Consistent decisions. Letting results and the right people speak.
Brutal facts.
This is where autistic leaders and autistic staff earn their keep and get punished for it at the same time. Directness delivers the brutal fact. The question is whether the room can receive it. In Collins's 4 practices, lead with questions, debate without coercion, autopsies without blame, red flag mechanisms, read like a description of a workplace where a blunt, accurate person can survive. If a leader loves this chapter, they have agreed in principle that being right and being socially smooth are different skills.
The hedgehog for autism.
Often already there. There is a theory in the autism literature called monotropism, Dinah Murray and colleagues, 2005, describing attention pulled tightly into a small number of deep interests. That is a hedgehog by temperament, so the coaching question flips. Not, can you focus, but has the economic circle been checked? Deep focus on something the market will not pay for is a hobby, not a company.
And first who?
2 things. Standard interviews tend to screen out autistic talent because they test social fluency rather than the job. So when a chief executive says they only put the right people on the bus, ask how they decide. And the seats matter more than Collins lets on. There is a research thread on job crafting, Amy Jesnevsky and Jane Dutton, 2001, showing people who can reshape their role perform better and stay longer. Shaping the seat to the person is the mechanism, not a favor.
Culture of discipline for this profile.
The accommodation model, quietly. Explicit expectations, clear structure, then real autonomy over how the work gets done. The difference from the ADHD pass is emphasis. For ADHD, the framework holds the leader steady. For autism, the framework makes the unwritten rules written.
Third pass, the leader who has both.
This is a different conversation because the two pulls point in opposite directions. The autistic pull is toward depth. One thing, done completely. The ADHD pull is toward the new. A leader with both can lurch and then hyperfocus on the thing they lurch to. From the outside, that looks inconsistent, and boards tend to read inconsistency as a character flaw rather than a wiring pattern.
So how does the book help?
Hedgehog becomes the tiebreaker. When the two pulls disagree, the 3 circles decide, not the mood of the week. The flywheel has to be built by other people because this leader will be brilliant at the push and unreliable at the cadence. And level 5 gives them a story for the board. Quiet, determined, erratic in direction until the hedgehog is set, then relentless. That is a pattern a board can understand if someone names it.
One caution before we close this out.
None of this is a diagnosis, and none of it describes any one person. It is a way of listening. When a leader tells you which chapter of this book they underlined, you are learning something about how they work, and these 3 passes give you a place to start.
So the recap in that frame, build the company around structure, not charisma. Put people in seats shaped to them. Make it safe to say the true thing. Pick one thing and let it be the tiebreaker, and push in the same direction until the wheel carries the weight so no single person's hardest day can stop it. Last piece, where does artificial intelligence fit in all of this?
Collins already wrote the rule. Technology accelerates momentum. It does not create it. A company with no hedgehog and no discipline will use AI to lurch faster. A company with both will use it to push the flywheel harder.
Be concrete. In the neurodivergent space, what does that look like?
The uses are already visible, and they line up with the book. Meeting transcription and summary takes the load off working memory and auditory processing, so a person can stay in the conversation instead of scrambling to take notes. That is first who. It keeps a capable person effective in their seat. Task decomposition, turning a big ambiguous goal into a sequence list with time estimates, is an executive function support a leader with ADHD can run on their own calendar. Drafting and tone checking works both ways. It softens a blunt message when softness is needed, and it lets someone who overthinks every email send one in 5 minutes.
And the brutal facts.
Two things. Rehearsing a hard conversation with an AI before you have it is a cheap way to prepare. And AI analysis of the company's own numbers can surface an uncomfortable trend without anyone having to be the messenger. That lowers the social cost of a red flag mechanism.
Give me the cautions.
Two, first, the evidence that AI tools improve outcomes for neurodivergent workers is early, mostly practitioner reports and small studies. Promising practice, not established. Second, the doom loop applies to tools. A new AI product every quarter is lurching. The disciplined version is Collins's own. Pick the one tool that fits the hedgehog. Use it seriously for 6 months, then measure whether the wheel turned.
Nora, thank you.
Thank you.
That is good to great. Tomorrow on 60 Books, Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell and the 10,000-hour rule that every executive has heard and most have never checked. I'm Miles. See you then.